Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good morning. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Later this hour, legislative budget analysts release a report on the potential costs of a plan to expand school voucher program in Arizona. Also, how members of the Navajo Nation are reacting to the planned closure of the Navajo Generating Station.
Cheers and jeers broke out several times in Phoenix City Council chambers as members tackled immigration last night. The council rejected a citizen request to declare Phoenix a sanctuary city, but voted to consider possible legal challenges to SB 1070, Arizona's controversial immigration law. Before the vote, council members listened to more than an hour of public comment. Often it was passionate, and at times it became personal. Take a listen.
My name is Maria Castro. I'm here as the daughter of a beautiful undocumented mother. And to say that I'm very disappointed in you, Mayor Stanton, you have confused my mother. You have increased the trauma and anxiety in my home and the homes across the city of Phoenix by saying that you are going to stand up to Trump, and you have not done so.
I suggest that those who want to live in a sanctuary city move to San Francisco.
We are here demanding a sanctuary city. We are here demanding that you defy SB 1070.
And I resent that very much because I am brown and I am originally Mexican. And when they compare me to this kind of people, it's not,
thank you, Ms.
it's
Case.
Not good.
Okay? Thank you, Ms. Case. Rocks.
Morally wrong laws need to be defied. They were defied in the Civil Rights Movement, and they need to be defied today.
This is the United States of America. We were built on laws. This isn't about being mean or being hateful. It's our immigration laws.
In addition to those comments, there were several outbursts from the audience. KJZZ's Christina Estes was at the meeting and joins me now. Christina, you described this as the most contentious council meeting you can recall.
It was not the most fun meeting I've attended. During the public comment period, several people were booed. Some people tried to drown out council members as they were talking. At least half a dozen times, the mayor had to interrupt and say, let him speak. I heard two people complain about hearing racist and inappropriate language as they sat in the audience. And then right after the council voted, supporters of making Phoenix a sanctuary city chanted, shame on you.
Now, we sort of expected the council to vote against the sanctuary city designation because that was the advice of the city attorney. Basically, the legal team said Phoenix can't tell police to ignore SB 1070, which requires local officers to comply with federal immigration enforcement, but the council voted to study possible legal challenges to SB 1070. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you clear on that? That was an interesting move. So they voted to go into executive session at a future date to explore legal options. And that did not sit well with Councilman Sal DeCicio.
Do you know what executive session is? It's a closed-door meeting. You'll never know what occurs in there. You'll never know what the discussions are because we're prohibited from talking about it.
DeCicio and Jim Waring were the only council members to vote no yesterday because they do not want the city possibly challenging SB 1070. Now, on the flip side, Councilman Michael Nowakowski pushed to do more. He wasn't interested in having a meeting on whether they should pursue legal action. Instead, he made a motion to challenge what he called this ugly, nasty, racist law.
So what happened with Nowakowski's motion?
Well, they didn't vote on it because it came up too late, according to council rules. Basically, someone else put a motion on the table before he did.
Mayor Greg Stanton has been very vocal against the Trump administration's immigration enforcement policies, but the city says, at least right now, they can't ignore state or federal immigration laws. So what's the mayor planning to do?
Well, he just created an ad hoc subcommittee to focus on the response to President Trump's recent executive order. Stanton thinks the federal government is taking aim at large cities. As an example, he used last week's deportation of a Phoenix mother with a felony conviction for using a false Social Security number. The subcommittee is tasked with looking at ways to improve policing and to help families facing what he calls potentially devastating circumstances.
So, the subcommittee, is that going to be really fast? Are we going to hear from them really soon?
Well, they're supposed to present their findings to the full city council by the end of March.
And, of course, we'll be covering that as well. KJZZ's Christina Estes, thank you.
You're welcome.
The discussion yesterday with the Phoenix City Council comes as local governments across the country have been debating whether to continue offering safe haven to undocumented immigrants. South of the border, Mexico City is implementing sanctuary city policies of its own. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia reports.
Mauricio Quesada is pointing at a poster. He's sharing his personal story with his classmates, almost all of whom migrated from Central America to Mexico City. Quesada was a social studies teacher in El Salvador, and every week he traveled 4 hours to his job.
When I came home one weekend, my wife told me that someone had been coming over at night and had been leaving envelopes under the door. They wanted me to pay them $150 every 2 weeks.
The envelopes were signed by the gang MS-13. Quesada made a relatively good living of $750 per month. He was able to pay for a while, but he was the only breadwinner for his wife, his two sons, and his grandson. When he started leaving the gang $85 or $75, they started following him.
You started seeing two individuals on bicycles. And when I crossed the street, they would be right behind me. They didn't do anything to me at that moment, but they were trying to make me scared and panic.
Quesada was worried about his family. So last summer, his wife and kids moved to his in-law's house, and he left to look for work in Mexico. Authorities here denied him his asylum application, saying he had no evidence of his hardship. To which he said, what more evidence than being 50 years old and leaving a good job that paid well?
For evidence, maybe I should have come without an arm or with two bullet wounds on my chest. Maybe that would be enough evidence. I came to Mexico only because I'm looking for a safe place for my family. That's my only goal.
Mexico received almost 9,000 asylum applications last year, and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees expects that number to more than double this year, in part because the U.S. has become less appealing. Within Mexico, the capital city has become a destination itself. It has policies that resemble those of American sanctuary cities. City officials say they don't report people's immigration status to the federal government. Also, Mexico City is the only local government in the country that issues ID cards to migrants. This gives them access to public health services. And the city gives migrants money to help them start their own businesses. In 2015, the city funded more than 350 projects. Rubén Fuentes Rodríguez heads Mexico City's program for migrants.
Migrants, regardless of their nationality, are not prosecuted in Mexico City, at least not by our office. Our role is to help them.
These policies are a result of a law from 2011 that made Mexico City what officials here call a hospitable city for migrants. Elisa Ortega Velázquez does migration research at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. She says Mexico City is the only city in the country that is offering services to immigrants.
It's been about 20 years that Mexico City is governed by left, which is keen to provide citizens with some rights, such as gay marriage and abortion.
And yet, many advocates complain that migrants often don't get the services that the law affords them, or that some local officials do report them to federal immigration authorities. Gabriela Hernandez runs a shelter for adult men.
There are two speeches. There's the one that the mayor gives, and there's the one that his public servants give.
Servidores públicos.
Hernandez says she gives the mayor the benefit of the doubt. She says she believes he wants to help, but just lacks follow-through.
I think we should work on making this a sanctuary city, but we should work on actually getting things done, not just on politicians saying they're doing them.
Mauricio Quesada, the teacher from El Salvador, is participating in a class that can make him eligible for the city's business grant program. For his presentation, he drew a mountain with a big sun shining above.
The moral is that there's a long road left to travel. And little time to rest. I can't stop walking until I see the clarity of the sun.
But Quesada's needs are immediate, and the city's grant program won't deliver until July at the earliest. He says he recently got a job as a carpenter, but that he still hasn't collected enough money to send his family. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
Legislation aimed at expanding Arizona's Empowerment Scholarship Account System, less formally known as private school vouchers, has been making its way through the state legislature. Bills in both the House and Senate are still awaiting a vote before the full chambers. Supporters say they'll save taxpayers money, but a new report from the Joint Legislative Budget Committee says they'd actually cost the state more. Here to break that down for us is KJZZ's Carrie Young. So, Carrie, how much extra money are we talking about here?
Well, under the law as it's written, the JLBC estimates about 2.6% of eligible students would take advantage of the program by 2020. That would result in an increase in the general fund cost by about $12.9 million. Then when the cap on enrollment is lifted or self-destructs in 2020, they estimate that would go up even further. The general cost rise would be about $24.5 million, and that's by 2021.
Now, Carrie, we've heard from Debbie Lesko, the Senate version sponsor, that ESAs or vouchers would ultimately save taxpayers money. Can you explain her argument and how the report sort of weighs in on that?
Okay, so Lesko argues that it takes about $9,500 in total to educate a child in an Arizona public schools. She then says with the average of a $5,600 voucher that the state gives out, now that's for a child without special needs, that is resulting in an overall taxpayer savings. Now, what the report points out is that $9,500 figure that Lesko is citing is actually including federal tax money and local tax dollars in addition to general fund money. So when you look just at the amount that's coming out of the general fund, it's actually more under the expansion.
So it's not really an apples to apples comparison here.
It's not, no. And so Howie Fisher with Capital Media Services did manage to catch up with Debbie Lesko for just a few minutes yesterday to get her to comment on this new report. She did say she hadn't looked at it fully and wanted a little bit more time to analyze that and have the JLBC just sort of walk her through that.
The report just came out from JLBC, and so I'm having my assistant right now request a meeting with JLBC so they can go over the fiscal note with me so I have a better understanding, and then I'll be able to give you a better answer.
Now, Curry, we're still awaiting a vote before both the full House and Senate on this issue. How likely is it that this legislation will pass?
Well, just looking in the Senate, it looks like it could be close. While Republicans do hold a 17-13 advantage, Senator Kate Brophy McGee, who is a Republican, says she is already opposed. That could leave Senator Frank Pratt, who is a Republican from Casa Grande, as the deciding vote. And Pratt said Wednesday that he hadn't yet made up his mind.
Plenty to keep our eyes on. That's KJZZ's Carrie Young. Thanks, Carrie.
Thanks, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this morning. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. President Trump says it's a leaky, leaky ship of state.
Papers are being leaked. Things are being leaked. It's criminal action, criminal act. And it's been going on for a long time before me. But now it's really going on. And people are trying to cover up for a terrible loss that the Democrats had under Hillary Clinton. I think it's very, very unfair what's happened to General Flynn, the way he was treated, and the documents and papers that were illegally, I stress that, illegally leaked.
President Trump does some public bailing when asked about the Mike Flynn scandal, with visiting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu standing by. The Trump performance seemed to alarm even the cool conservative Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee.
I don't want to get hysterical about this all of a sudden and throwing out. I mean, I think we've got an issue that's real. It's important to our nation. I think we all need it in a sober way, regardless of party, figure out a way to not cause there to be this huge distrust of what may be happening here in our country relative to a country that is not our friend.
Senator Corker calling for sobriety in a conversation with Todd Zwillich. He certainly is old enough to remember the chaotic days of erratic Russian leader Boris Yeltsin during the 1990s. How might Russia have moved events along in the General Flynn fiasco? Does the content of intercepted calls between Trump aides and Russian intelligence officials during the campaign represent a deliberate effort to create mischief? Meanwhile, there does seem to be a degree of Russian reveling in all this. The deployment of a cruise missile earlier this week and what's being described as the loitering of a Russian spy ship 30 miles off the coast of Connecticut. How is all this being reported inside Russia? Charles Maines is a longtime independent radio producer and reporter based in Moscow. Charles, welcome.
Good to be with you.
So how much fun is the Russian media having with this story, just before we get into the facts?
Well, you know, the Russian media has essentially talked about, you know, all these allegations that have come over the past months about the Trump campaign and Russian contacts. And, you know, in a way, the Russian position hasn't really ever changed. They've said that they've had nothing to do with it. All the hacking story they've denied. And certainly they've denied these last allegations by the New York Times that the Trump campaign was actively in cahoots with the Russian government.
And was there any coverage of the Flynn resignation and, you know, who he is, you know, his potential relationship with the folks inside Russia?
Well, there's been some coverage. I have to say that initially when the news broke, it wasn't covered by some of the main channels here, like State Channel 1. But it was certainly, you know, Flynn is well known to RT, for example, Russia Today, where he is an often guest there. So there was some coverage there. And I think just generally speaking, there's a sense that General Flynn was an ally. He was someone within the Trump camp that was pushing for better relations with Russia, something that the president has also said. And so I think there's a sense that, they lost one of their own.
You know, the evolution of Russia post-Soviet, you really had a period of time where, you know, Russia in the West was viewed as something of a basket case. And the Putin years have really been a period of extreme stability. If you look at the United States, it would seem as though Russians on the street can look at Washington and possibly chuckle a little bit about their own experience.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. Certainly, I think they look at what's happening in the U.S. and they see, basically chaos coming out of the White House. But it's not all good for the Russians in the sense that certainly on the government level, there's they look at, you know, conflicting signals in terms of what the Trump administration wants to do relative to Russia. Candidate Trump often said he wanted better relations. He suggested that maybe he was interested in removing sanctions that were imposed on Russia over the Ukraine issue and over Crimea. Well, then you get to his administration, and suddenly some of his key cabinet posts, including Nikki Haley at the UN, saying that essentially linking sanctions relief to the return of Crimea to Ukraine, which is a non-starter issue for the Russians. Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, is meeting with Rex Tillerson today in Bonn for the first time. And you know, maybe they'll be able to straighten some of these things out. But certainly, I think that they're learning that the Trump, certainly President Trump, is a chaotic figure. If anything, I think Vladimir Putin, for all the stability he brings to Russian politics at home, he's often been the guy on the international stage who's unpredictable, and he uses that to his advantage. Well, now Trump is using that same technique. Nobody quite knows what he really stands for. During the presidential campaign, candidate Trump was often promoted in the Russian media as kind of this, you know, hero for the working class, an honest broker, a real true honest politician, whereas Hillary Clinton was sort of hopelessly corrupt. And, you know, I think now they're starting to get this kind of buyer's remorse with Trump. There's been just a few columns in some of the main dailies here saying, you know, this guy is so unstable that it just doesn't make sense to hitch Russian policy to him. We just should chart our own course and hope that we can, you know, cooperate where we can.
Do Russian reporters and people on the street use the O word in describing Donald Trump, oligarch?
No, I think they look at him as a successful businessman. I think they look more to the aspirational parts of Donald Trump. Certainly also in the media, they celebrate his virility, you know, the hands and everything like that. So I think that, you know, Trump, to a certain degree, appeals to Russians as kind of a colorful guy. But he is reminiscent in some ways of some of the sort of business guys from the 90s, the oligarchs, as you say. So in some ways, he represents this sort of, you know, older 90s Russian form of business, you know, constantly trading, constantly moving up the ladder. So I think, though, that they're more intrigued by him than repulsed.
And what about the leaks, the sources of leaks coming out of the conversations between Flynn and Russian officials? Could they have a Russian source, Russian translators, people who have it in for Donald Trump, or at least for Mike Flynn?
Well, I suppose anything's possible. We still don't know what was actually said during these conversations. We haven't, certainly I haven't seen the transcripts. But I think it's worth pointing out that the Russian ambassador in Washington certainly is aware that he's being wiretapped. He's not a dummy. So, you know, I think that Kislyak, the Russian ambassador in D.C., was, I imagine, quite sort of holding his tongue during these talks, is the impression you have, because Russians are well-trained in this sense. So it's hard for me to imagine that the leaks came from this side. It sounds to me like, you know, the story adds up in this sense with what the security services in the U.S. are leaking to the media, that it's standard practice to wiretap foreign nationals, particularly in government, and certainly the Russians. And Flynn got caught.
I suppose in the old Soviet days, and there was some of this during Watergate when Nixon was, first viewed as this hugely powerful leader, you know, capable of almost anything during the Vietnam period, and then Watergate, you know, unraveled him completely. This was a opportune moment for the Soviets to, you know, display, you know, hydrogen bombs and, you know, parades in the street and all sorts of military prowess. Is there signs of, Russian mobilization or showing off military capability, that sort of thing?
Well, you know, the Russians are being accused of, you know, essentially breaking this Cold War era missile treaty, although they've denied this. This is a report that came out in the New York Times the other day. They say that nothing like this exists, and they're abiding by all their international requirements. I do think you see certainly the Russians aware of the expansion into Eastern Europe by NATO. I think they're really unnerved by, in particular, the presence of rotating forces, including U.S. troops, into Eastern Europe as sort of a sense of support to some of the Baltic states and some of the Eastern European countries on Russia's flank. So I think that there is certainly a sense that even today Mr. Putin made some announcements that essentially NATO was trying to contain Russia, and this was the primary threat that the Russians faced. So I think in some ways you have this certain buildup, and Vladimir Putin has been working at that for several years now. He's moved away from a very ineffectual contract army to something much more professional. They've got special forces that showed that they were quite capable in Crimea in particular, and also in Syria with some of the air campaign that they launched there. So I think you've seen just a general kind of buildup in militancy, and that also extends, I might add, to the Arctic.
The treaty violation that you referred to is this alleged deployment of a cruise missile. The Russians are denying that?
That's right. They say that formally they haven't been accused of violating the treaty, but that Russia remains committed to all its international commitments, including the treaty in question.
So a Russian spy ship loitering off the coast of Connecticut is also being denied.
That's right. The Russians, I mean, over the past several years, John, we've seen a lot of cases where, for example, Russian jets have been flying with their transponders off into the Black Sea, basically brushing over NATO forces, NATO ships in both the Baltic area, Baltic Sea, also in the Black Sea. So a lot of quite provocative behavior, but usually standard practice is to say that nothing occurred.
It was believed here in the United States that Putin preferred Donald Trump to any of the other characters who were running for office, including Hillary Clinton. Is there any sense of be careful what you wish for there in Moscow these days?
I think there is. I think there's just a little sense of buyer's remorse. You rightfully point out that they certainly were receptive to the message that was coming from candidate Trump, that he wanted better relations with Russia. Certainly there's this personal animosity that President Putin has for Hillary Clinton. He blames her for a series of protests, mass street protests that broke out after the parliamentary elections here in 2011, saying that she gave the, quote, signal to essentially the opposition to rally people and Russians against Putin on the streets of Moscow and other cities. So I mean, there was that all along. At the same time, now we have this kind of very impulsive figure in the White House, and I think the Russians are trying to figure out what exactly he stands for like everybody else.
Charles Maines, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Hey, thank you, John.
Charles Maines is an independent radio producer and reporter based in Moscow.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
Yesterday was the annual Environmental Day at the state capitol. Activists and students met with legislators and attended committee hearings to voice their support for environmental protection. So what environmental issues are on the table at the capitol this session? For more on this, we're joined now by the show's Lauren Gilger. And Lauren Phillison, what's going on?
Right. So I took that question to Sandy Barr. She's the director of the Grand Canyon chapter of the Sierra Club and one of the organizers of the event. And she said there were more than 200 people there from 26 different legislative districts at the Capitol yesterday involved in this. And she said they're looking at a number of issues, especially conserving water in our state. But in general, she doesn't think that a lot of what is going on at the state legislature is going to be good for our environment.
Today, in fact, they're looking at a repeal of the Arizona State Parks Board. And they want to take away the citizen oversight and the kind of transparency and public involvement that we got with our Parks Board. And we also are looking at water. Water is an issue every year. Unfortunately, the legislature hasn't been stepping up to do enough relative to conserving water and talking about the need to keep water in our rivers and streams. We are supporting a bill that will actually encourage people to do rainwater harvest. Another key issue is the citizen initiative and referendum process. The legislature doesn't like it because it's a check on the power of the legislature. That's what it was intended to be. And so frequently they try to find ways to weaken citizen initiatives. And even today there's a bill up that erects all kinds of impediments to getting something on the ballot, which is already very difficult. And for us, that's important because environmental protection issues, sometimes like things like the Heritage Fund, that was established by the voters. Previous conservation funds have been established by the voters. And so those are the kinds of things that we need to be able to take directly to the people because there is public support and the legislature is, you know, trying to get in the way of that.
So looking at the citizen initiative issue first, then, do you have any initiatives that you are considering in the future if things don't happen the way you want in this session?
There's always discussion about ballot measures right now. There's been discussion over the last several years about doing something on solar energy because of some of the hostility coming from the Corporation Commission and the legislature. There's ongoing discussion about reinstating the State Parks Heritage Fund. You know, the legislature doesn't really seem to value parks the way that the people do, and so that's one of the reasons why frequently you have to go to the ballot.
And then let's dig into this water issue a little bit more. Like you said, this is always a big deal in Arizona. You said the legislature is unfortunately not doing what you would like them to be doing to conserve water in our state. What do you think they could be doing?
Well, we think that one thing they could do, it's a relatively small bill, but they could support this bill to promote rainwater harvesting. Another thing that they could do is reject. There's actually a bill that would really delay and create more problems for addressing water rights relative to surface water, rivers and streams. We don't think that is a good idea, as a number of the Native American tribes are opposing that bill because they see it as a way of putting them at a disadvantage in the water discussions. But ultimately, we need to strengthen the Groundwater Management Act. There have been efforts to weaken it, and that's the act that helps to limit groundwater pumping in certain parts of the state in order to protect the rivers and streams that we have in Arizona that are still flowing, you know, that we've dried up quite a few of them through groundwater pumping and diversions.
That was Sandy Barr, director of the Grand Canyon chapter of the Sierra Club. She helped organize the Environmental Day at the state capitol yesterday.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you.
This week, an Arizona power company announced it would shut down a northern Arizona coal-fired power plant in 3 years. That's 25 years earlier than the Navajo Nation anticipated. While environmentalists celebrate the closure, hundreds of Navajo people who rely on those jobs are devastated. From KJZ's East Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laura Morales reports.
When Marlene Fowler wakes up in Caibito, 30 miles south of Page, she can see a yellow-green haze on the horizon. But Fowler's not worried about the pollution. It's her husband's job at the Navajo Generating Station that has her in a panic.
Hopefully it doesn't shut down. Even though, you know, even though they say the pollution is all this and that, but it's been there years, you know. I'm doing biscuits and gravy for the community, seniors.
Fowler gets $10 an hour as a cook for the senior center, but it's her husband's paycheck the family depends on. He's a part-time mechanic for the power plant. Fowler says without the plant work, he'll have to travel to various odd jobs.
He has to be here with his kids, you know. It's going to cost a lot of gas and mileage on the vehicles. We don't have transportation for him to go out to job sites. They have to pay their motels and meals and lodging and stuff.
Outside the kitchen, Lorinda Bennett and her husband, who's retired from the plant, sit on the senior center couch waiting for biscuits and gravy.
I have two boys and three girls and a lot of grandkids. I have a daughter that's working there and two son-in-laws working there. They're close by. We see them almost every day.
Bennett worries the plant shutdown will take her children and grandkids far away.
Our kids are going to move away and our grandkids. And you know that's what they're planning on if they're already looking for another job.
The Navajo Nation has relied on the coal industry for the last four decades. The industry and energy companies have provided hundreds of families with five-figure salaries. 90% of the power plant employees are Navajo. The revenue, taxes, and royalties all make up about a third of the tribe's operating budget and the majority of the Hopi tribe's budget. The Salt River Project and other plant owners say natural gas is much cheaper and makes more economic sense. A plant closure means the coal mine that feeds the plant would also likely shut down. Many compare the Navajo Nation to a developing country, with 50% unemployment and increasing violent crime. There's one police officer for every 130 square miles on the sprawling reservation. Joanne Sakoti is Caibito's community service coordinator.
Crimes and people hurting one another is already here.
With more Navajos out of work, Sakoti worries about more people turning to a life of crime.
I know it's going to affect everyone. It's going to traumatize everyone because everyone's going to think that this is it. So everyone needs to just get out of their comfort zone and go back to school.
Coconino County Supervisor Lena Fowler agrees. Fowler has been trying to bring together three colleges from the region to build an education center in Page. She wants to give power plant employees a reason to stay.
These are the homeowners. These are the people that come and shop. If that dollar flow is not there, where are we going to get that? We don't want to see businesses' doors close.
Fowler started work on an economic impact plan when she thought she had 25 years to prepare.
How do we help ourselves? How do we help our children? How do we help our neighbors? How do we as a community come together to help each other, to keep our population whole and families whole?
The Salt River Project is talking to the Navajo Nation about jobs needed to dismantle and clean up the plant. The tribe is also planning to recruit new businesses to the reservation. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
The graphic novel has become one of the most popular forms of print books, generating more than $1 billion in sales. And the medium features a broad base of characters and topics, from superheroes like Batman to real-life heroes like civil rights leader John Lewis, who was featured in a recent series. Award-winning author and illustrator Mark Siegel, founder of First Second Books, will be lecturing on the Great American Graphic Novel this afternoon at 1:30 at Payne Hall on ASU's Tempe campus. And Mark joins us now for a few minutes. Mark, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, so people talk about comic books and graphic novels being very similar. Are graphic novels a way for people to do a deeper dive into really serious topics?
In a way, I mean, they're not necessarily serious, but they're maybe longer and bigger. They're, you know, some people say graphic novels are comics with a spine. So, but comics is the medium. It's basically the handwriting.
What do graphic novels and their popularity tell us about how we read today? Do people need the graphics, the illustrations to go along with the words?
Well, I think we're in an increasingly visual world, and the people, you know, our kids are growing up with just saturated with imagery all the time from all different devices. The thing about comics, you know, at first some librarians were excited about the graphic novels boom because they thought like, okay, this is this new visual literacy everybody was talking about. And they thought, well, this is good for reluctant readers. This is a way into reading, you know, so quote, real books. And it turns out that the graphic novels oftentimes have a vocabulary and a depth of plot or story that is way beyond the age of the readers. So it's actually not necessarily an easier read.
Well, to sound real stodgy, what about there are classics that have been made into graphic novels? Are we missing something by... Are we taking away from imagination at all if we're seeing what someone else thinks of the images? It's almost like if we see an actor play someone who is in our favorite book, it's like, oh, I guess I'm always going to visualize that actor playing that role.
Totally, totally. I know. I have that with the book Wonder. They're making a movie out of it. I'm like, no, I don't want to. Don't take away my Augie, you know, that I've got in my mind. But yeah, no, I agree. And I think the beauty of prose is that it does certain things very well and other things not. Movies do some things that prose can't do. But then it has its limitations. So every medium is a constraint, you know, and the graphic novel has some very interesting constraints. So the ones, I'm not a big fan of the Classics Illustrated. I think, you know, why, you know, Mary Shelley doesn't need us to, you know, I mean, we've got the movies, we've got everything on Frankenstein. But when graphic novels use the medium intelligently, it's magic. You know, it's the dance of words and pictures. And Art Spiegelman says this interesting thing that, you know, balloons, the word balloons, when they're done well, they're like the brain works. We have puffs of thought. We don't actually think in paragraphs and long soliloquies. We actually have these puffs of thoughts that organize themselves organically, you know, and comics can do that. And so they kind of fit with how our brain works when they're good.
Well, how important is the visual art in terms of its quality? There are people who love comic books, love comic strips that are really not that well drawn,
yeah,
but it doesn't really take away from the
theme. No, that's right. That's great. I love that. I mean, that's actually, so it's interesting because I sometimes, as an editor, you know, I publish people who come from other fields, you know, so we have like playwrights, we have novelists writing scripts for us, and there's a learning curve of getting into the medium itself. But what's interesting with comics is that when people come from illustration, they think it's about making beautiful pictures, and it's not. It's not actually pretty pictures. The good ones are it's a visual handwriting. So what you're getting is you actually need to, and you know how some people are very resistant to graphic novels, and still today, usually from the older generations, and they kind of flip through them fast, and they say, I don't get it. I meet this a lot, you know, and many times what they need to do is just slow down and learn not just to read the words, but to actually read the pictures.
So can any story be told in that form?
I would say no. I mean, yes and no, probably. It depends. You know, it's like writing, you know, when you connect with an author, it's another human universe. It's another human spirit. You're connecting with like the inner life of someone, and some of them speak to you, some of them resonate with you, and some leave you cold, you know. So it's the same thing, you know. So it's whose hands is it in? Somebody is going to take the graphic novel and give you this most brilliant, you know, nonfiction. We have one of our bestsellers is about Feynman, the physicist Feynman.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And now it's actually in the canon of Feynman books. It was a number one New York Times bestseller. But when it was pitched, you know, I really had to sell it because I was like, well, it's about physics. It's about math, you know. But when you read it, it's magic. It takes you in there.
Mark Siegel is founder of First Second Books. He's lecturing on the Great American Graphic Novel this afternoon at 1:30 at Payne Hall on ASU's Tempe campus. And tomorrow he'll be leading a workshop for ASU's Center for Science and the Imagination on the making of the graphic novel. Mark, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. One of the fun things about producing a news magazine for you every day is that we can share some great voices and intriguing conversations in a variety of formats. We bring you the latest national news, but we also talk with artists and scientists.
And now we present Dr. Art Markman and Dr. Bob Duke. They're psychologists and consider the big ideas and how our minds think about and process the world.
Think about this. our brains change.
Memory is an amazing thing.
What you think is in
our
there
brains
is
aren't
really
finished. They're not fully cooked yet.
You go with your heart.
We don't have any idea why
we're
doing
so
most
smart
of the things that we're doing. But here's the deal. That credulity is helped along by the fact that there are things that have an emotional appeal that lead us to want to think in a certain way. I'm Bob Duke.
I'm Art Markman.
I'm Rebecca McEnroy, and this is Two Guys on Your Head. Today, the psychology of fake news.
What has become enculturated in many people is the idea that everybody's got a spin, everything has a spin. And if you see something that you don't like, it's probably because somebody is tweaking the data or spinning something in a way that is not factually accurate. Well, that's a problem, because it's one thing to have an argument or a disagreement with somebody about your interpretation of facts. It's quite another thing to not agree on what the facts actually are.
But this isn't new.
Yeah.
So the concept of propaganda is essentially fake news. It is trying to undermine a particular view of what the facts are that has two influences on people. So one is the effect of a particular piece of false information on your later beliefs. But then there's a second influence, which has to do with your beliefs about what constitutes a reliable source. So even though human beings are by and large credulous, meaning they tend to believe what people are telling them, human beings are also quite good at marking particular sources of information as flawed sources of information. And this happens quite early. So there's a lot of really cool evidence from developmental psychology on this, for example, where so you have a kid who's learning words and they have two sources that they could get a word from. And the experiment starts by labeling an object that the kid is already familiar with. So let's say there's a little rubber duck, and one person says, oh, look, an elephant. And the other one says, oh, look, a duck. Okay. So that's giving you information about which of these people is a reliable source of information. Now there's a new object. And one of the person, the previously unreliable person says, look, a wug. And the previously reliable source says, look, a Dax. The kid is more likely to choose the word Dax, the one that was associated with the reliable source, rather than the word wug that was associated with the unreliable source, suggesting that they get a sense of who in your environment is giving you reliable information. The danger with this whole onslaught of fake news is that it undermines people's ability to figure out who the reliable sources are in a way that now makes it difficult to know who should I be listening to and who shouldn't I be listening to, in a way that then makes the facts a free-for-all, particularly because most of us live in a world in which we cannot independently verify most of the pieces of information that we have to believe in order to be able to navigate the world.
Right. And just to expand on Art's example a little bit, which is a great example, done with, by the way, very, very young children. The kid can only respond the way Art described if the kid actually knows what a duck is. So if you're talking about something about which you have no information, like you've never seen a duck, and some person says elephant, and some person says duck, well, then that person is just as credible as somebody else. So if you're not, I don't know, take something random. Like if you're not a climate scientist and you don't know how climate data are collected or how many sources there are or how somebody can possibly know what the level of the sea is, like the whole sea, you mean? So you don't understand any of that. Well, you don't know what a duck is. So when somebody calls a duck an elephant, you think, what? Could be. Seems reasonable to me.
Now, I know what you're saying out there. You're saying... Sure, I might fall for one of those fake news stories. But then as soon as I find out it's fake, because somebody sends me the link to Snopes or one of those other great sites that tracks down these internet hoaxes, as soon as I know it's false, what's the harm? Because, you know, I now I know it's false.
And that would be so wrong.
And that would be wrong.
That would be so wrong.
And the reason for that is something called the continued influence effect, which is the observation that if I find out something that I later discover to be false, That piece of information continues to affect my judgments. It continues to affect my beliefs, even though I know it's false.
Yep. One of my favorite, well, not my favorite, but one of the most interesting LBJ stories is when he was, it might have been the first time or second time he was running for Congress in Texas, and his campaign was about to put out a story that his opponent was having an affair. And like the day they were going to put this out, one of his aides came to me, you know, we found out that that story was not true, you know. And Johnson said, we're going to put it out anyway. And he said, well, we know it's not true. He said, I know, but let's make him deny it. Because what Johnson understood was, well, once that gets in the minds of people, it doesn't matter what contravening evidence comes out or say, well, actually, we were wrong about that. Because first of all, there's the primacy of hearing that, right? So you've got the jolt of, really? And now that's in there. And then there's not a commensurate jolt when you find out that it's not true, right? All the punch comes with the initial exposure to the idea.
Yeah. And we then begin to justify why it may still have been true, even though it was false.
Yeah.
So like who, you start to say, well, why would we even have heard of this if it wasn't true? And on top of that, because memory retrieval happens automatically, now whenever you think about this event or this individual, you also think about that other piece of information. And even if you know it's false, there are two problems. The first, if you're in a hurry, you don't really necessarily have the time to go, oh, I heard this thing. Oh, and it's false. So I should discount that, because that takes a lot of effort. And second of all, a lot of the fake news that we get is designed not just to create a belief in a particular fact, but as Bob was saying, to create an emotional reaction. And those emotional reactions, you may still get those, even as you come to believe that this piece of information was false. And now what you get is just an association between that individual or that event and that emotional response, which then affects your interpretation of everything else.
Good Thursday morning. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix, along with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear about the refugee policy and how that could affect the country going forward. And we'll also go to President Trump's news conference announcing the new Labor Secretary nominee.
Over the past 5 years, Grand Canyon University has built up the school's purple presence in West Phoenix. Yesterday, local officials and school leaders came together to debut even more development at 27th Avenue and Camelback. KJZZ's Casey Kuhn was there, and she's here now. So, Casey, this 37 acres, it doesn't have more housing or classrooms. Describe what they've built and what was there before.
So before GCU bought and developed this corner, there were apartment complexes, a hotel, and a building for a swap meet. Now it looks drastically different, with a huge modern geometrical building lining Camelback Road. In those buildings are offices, there's a new restaurant, and that old hotel, GCU actually renovated it and is using it as a training ground for their hospitality management students.
So the school is investing hundreds of millions of dollars in these expansions with a lot of support from local politicians. What types of programs do they have to work with the local community to keep the neighbors involved?
So GCU's President Brian Mueller mentioned at the event that he'll extend a $1 million contract with the Phoenix Police. It's in its fourth year now, and he says that crime has actually dropped in the surrounding area and that the school went into the neighborhood to actually find locals who could actually work at the university. And it's all as a commitment to the area. So here's Mueller.
It's a big decision not to move the campus to Scottsdale, Paradise Valley, or any of those places. This was really one of the worst crime areas in Phoenix in 2010, and it was at that point that we said that's going to be part of our Christian mission. We are going to use this neighborhood as our greater cause, the greater good that we would be a part of.
Mueller says a professor with the university also has worked with local businesses as a way of providing a professional resource to help them out.
With Grand Canyon spreading out more and buying up more land, there's bound to be some neighborhood backlash, I would imagine. What have local business owners experienced, and what are they hoping to see more of?
So, Mark, I think the key word here is gentrification. I spoke to some local business owners right across the street from this brand new development, and it seemed like everyone was kind of skeptical of what GCU's been doing. Mm. One local carniceria owner says he was going to expand his services, actually, for new student customers, like sandwiches to go, stuff like that. But he never actually got there because he never sees any students. He says with GCU building up everything on campus and providing everything for the students there, he hasn't seen any students venture out into the neighborhood. And a used car salesman, Jose Infante, has worked on 27th Avenue and Camelback for 20 years. He says since GCU's developed out, he hasn't heard much from the school itself, but would be happy to work with them on addressing crime and local business.
I really wish that they could send somebody around the neighborhood. What about the business there around on the other side of the street? Have they come over and ask, how can we help you? How can we improve? No, they have not.
So GCU President Brian Mueller says by working with the Phoenix Police, crime has actually gone down around GCU, but Infante says he hasn't seen a lot of change on his end.
That's KJZZ's Casey Kuhn. Thanks, Casey.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration's executive action temporarily barring citizens of seven nations from coming into the U.S. is on hold, thanks to a ruling by a panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. But this is a relatively early chapter of what many observers expect to turn out to be a lengthy tale. The Trump administration argues the U.S. needs to get a handle on vetting of people from those seven countries, that the nation should hit the pause button. President Trump has said the vetting needs to be up to what he's calling extreme. To help us better understand the executive action and its possible future, I'm joined by Matt Zapatosky, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Matt, what are the arguments for and against the constitutionality of this executive action?
There are sort of two things going on here. In the immediate term, we've seen like short-term arguments about whether the ban should be put on hold. But that doesn't get to the broad question of whether at the end of the day this will be constitutional. The question there is essentially, was this ban intended to discriminate? So the president has broad powers to set immigration policy, and he can stop sort of any class of people from coming into the country as long as he has some kind of rational basis to do so. But what he can't do is just simply discriminate, in this case it would be against Muslims, and then use the national security reasons as kind of a guise for that. So the people who say this is constitutional say, look, the bar is very low for what he needs to demonstrate to use his power to block people from coming into the country. He just needs to have some kind of rational basis. It's no secret that the seven countries at issue here have had some struggles with terrorism. So that's his rational basis. The other side says, well, you got to look farther than that. Look at his campaign trail comments about wanting a Muslim ban. Look at what Rudy Giuliani said here recently, that President Trump called him up, used the phrase Muslim ban, and then Rudy Giuliani sort of told him how to do that legally. The other side says that demonstrates this is just a tool to discriminate against Muslims, and therefore it's unconstitutional. It violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
And there have even been some folks, to get away from the constitutional question for a moment, who have wondered about actual terrorist attacks that were carried out successfully. No one from any of those seven countries, and people wondered about Saudi Arabia and our complicated relationship with them. Has that come up more, the idea that, yes, there's concern about what may be a disguised, not very well disguised, Muslim ban, but on top of that, is there a concern about what those countries that were selected, and there may be countries that actually were more dangerous that would make more sense to have the quote-unquote extreme vetting?
So judges have really hammered the Trump administration on this point. They say, look, you say you need this for national security reasons, so point to us a terrorist attack that occurred involving a resident or a citizen of one of these seven countries. Now, you can kind of look at the attack in Columbus, Ohio, the young man who was a refugee from Somalia who drove his car into a crowd of people. I suppose they could point at that as one example, but they cite in the executive order itself September 11th, and none of the attackers from there were from Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Iraq, or Yemen. So, and really in most of the high-profile attacks you think about, San Bernardino, Orlando, the attackers in both of those were not from any of these seven countries either. So a lot of judges and people who oppose the ban say that national security argument is a little specious. If this is for national security reasons, in some ways, why not expand it even? And so it encompasses some countries whose residents have been involved in terrorist attacks.
Matt, would you or anyone else be surprised if this ends up before the Supreme Court?
You know, not a long time ago, feels like a long time ago, a couple weeks ago when this thing started, I thought the only court in the country that can truly decide this thing is the Supreme Court. I mean, this is a policy that affects the entire country. We can't have different immigration policies in different states. But the administration has been reluctant to take it to the Supreme Court, at least in the posture it's at now. And the posture it's at now is they're just sort of haggling over whether there's a pressing national security reason to lift a judge's freeze on the ban. So they have a little bit of an uphill battle there. I think in the short term, it actually looks like it is not headed to the Supreme Court. In the long run, though, I do still think that this ultimately will get before the Supreme Court, because that's the only judicial body that can truly, like, come through with a ruling that everyone in the country would accept. I mean, I imagine there would be a lot of people wouldn't be pleased if the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals set the whole country's immigration policy on this issue.
The executive order mentions that the Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security could in the future add countries to the list. Do we know how broad that is and how often, and if this is held up as constitutional, how extensive could they make the list? Would there be any provisions to limit that?
They've been asked about that in the past, because I think that's what a lot of people fear, that, look, this is just kind of like a teaser. They're going to expand this thing. If he had a national security reason to put anybody else on the list, he could. I should caveat that with the Secretary of Homeland Security, John Kelly, was asked about this at a recent congressional hearing, and he said, look, we don't have any immediate plans to add anyone to this list, and this list is only supposed to be temporary, you know, I think 90 days for the people from these seven countries, 120 days for refugees, and then they're going to reassess. I would imagine at that time, maybe sooner now that the order is on hold, that they will just unveil these new extreme vetting measures and there won't be a sort of banned list. But the president is certainly within his authority to stop people from coming into this country. It's not out of the realm of possibility. He could expand the list in any sort of way he wants, as long as he can come up with a basis for it.
Matt Zapatosky is national security reporter for The Washington Post.
Good morning. It's the show. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein and John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
The shock of the Trump immigration ban, even with the block by the courts, can make a trip to the border, or more specifically to the airport, feel like a serious trauma from fear of detention or actual treatment by border agents. What can they ask? What can they do? Can they take and search your all-important phone or laptop? Answer, yes. If out of some impulse of civil libertarianism you smash your cell phone or laptop or iPad with your foot in front of an agent, you can be subject to arrest. And they can probably easily piece together anything you think you may have destroyed anyway. But authorities cannot force you to unlock your phone. You got that going for you. What are your real rights? Wouldn't it be great if in a cold sweat you ran into this guy?
Yeah, my name is Ray Kozlowski, associate professor of political science at the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, which is at the University at Albany.
Oh, my luck, Ray. These are hard days. These are all hard questions, don't you think?
The way in which things were implemented, the fact that there was little in the way of guidance given to Customs and Border Protection officers, that CBP was not really consulted in developing the guidance, has led, of course, to the chaos that we saw.
CBP, who are they? This is important.
This is the part of the Department of Homeland Security which is in charge of inspections at ports of entry, all the official border crossing points, and also includes the Border Patrol.
Ray says the fact that they weren't consulted in the creation of these regulations is part of the problem. But exactly where are you when you enter a country and are in that no man's land between the tarmac and the entrance gate?
People who enter in the United States or other countries have authorization with a visa, or if they're from a country that's on the visa waiver program in the United States, to arrive just with a passport. And that gives them the authority to travel, to present themselves to a border official. And essentially, it's not until one has that interview and has documents inspected that one, in a sense, enters.
So my fate is controlled by these folks, right? They can detain me for long amounts of time. I mean, what are my rights? What should I do?
Probably it's best to be respectful, to be cooperative, and to be forthcoming. If you have nothing to hide, et cetera, the best thing is, that kind of a policy.
So no terrorism jokes, duh. But what are my actual rights, say, under the Vienna Convention on Consular Rights?
One can, if there are issues, have access to have a call to your embassy or consulate of your country. As a national of another country, you can get relief in that way to a certain extent. And the U.S. is bound to work with their consulate authorities.
So that might help me if I'm a foreign national or traveling from another country. In theory, you can't be subjected to inhumane conditions, right? Because of the Helsinki Human Rights Accords. But for U.S. citizens?
U.S. citizens, all states are obliged to accept their own nationals. So people traveling with U.S. passports, that you have a right to enter, in a sense, to come in, come back home.
Can they search you? What's the process?
When individuals are entering into the United States, they present their passport. Questions are asked. Why are you coming? Where are you from? Et cetera. These are the standard things. And if there's some indicator, whether it's a hit on a watch list or if there's some anomaly in the travel pattern, say you booked a one-way ticket with cash, that always raises the red flags, then individuals might be put then in secondary inspection, as it's called, where there are additional questions and where the person's luggage will be examined, etc.
So no time limits in that case, Ray. It's not really a normal time, huh?
Think about this. You've got the chaos on top of just your everyday drug smuggling and human smuggling that is going on. So that makes matters more difficult. And there's only so many officers and lines, and that, of course, will lead to more backups and then the airlines having delayed flights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this becomes a real problem.
That's Ray Kozlowski, along with John Hockenberry at our partner, The Takeaway.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.